Our next speaker today is, we're pleased to have Rick Wilkin here from the U.S. EPA from Ada, Oklahoma, and I think he's our only speaker today who actually had to jump on an airplane to get here, so we appreciate that. And it wasn't hard to snare Rick. It turns out that Rick is a native son from Minnesota. He went to school at the university here, and he grew up in Minnesota, so... And in fact, he used to work for Ernie Lehman years ago. So he has plenty of ties to Minnesota, and we're pleased to have him here. He's going to talk to us today about monitored natural attenuation of inorganic contaminants in groundwater.
Great. Thanks. Well, good morning. As Steve said, I'm going to talk a little bit about this topic of monitored natural attenuation of inorganics and contaminants. In recent years, there's been some developments in that field, and Steve thought it would be a topic of interest for this group, and particularly at this meeting. And as Steve mentioned, I was really kind of excited about coming back here. I don't get to Minnesota very often, and so I was happy to be able to come on the plane and take this trip here. And because, as he mentioned, I grew up here, went to the University of Minnesota, and came out of the geology department. And after that experience, I went to work for Ernie, basically as a field grunt, collecting rock samples, soil samples, boots on the ground, as Jim Miller mentioned earlier in his talk. And that experience, it was a great job, a great experience, but it basically told me I should go back to school and try maybe to do some other things. But working for Ernie was fun. I mean, I got to go to different places in the country, different types of projects, one of which was in northern Minnesota in the Duluth complex. And so I was really interested in hearing Jim's talk this morning to hear about what was going on in the geology. A lot of those things I'd forgotten and gratefully have forgotten what a troctolite was and what have you. But, and he showed the picture of Paul Weiblin and J.C. Green, and that brought back memories of going on field trips with U of M and UMD along the North Shore. And as soon as I saw Professor Weiblin on the screen, the phase diagrams did come pouring back to me. So I was hoping that he would show some, actually. And I'm going to warn you that I'm actually going to show some EH-PH diagrams. So you're not out of the woods there. Just to finish up this kind of long introduction, one of the other projects that Ernie sent me working on was in Helena, Montana. And years later, then, as I went to EPA and started a career there, one of the first projects, major feature, field projects that I got involved with was back in Helena, Montana. So that's kind of my full circle. But I'll steal from your talk, Ernie. So anyway, it's good to be here. We'll move on here and start talking about some issues that I'm going to cover. I want to first talk a little bit about EPA, the kind of organization of EPA. Depending on who you get presenting to you, you might get a different flavor. So it's kind of nice to have that context. And then I want to spend most of the talk introducing this new technical guidance. It's not policy, it's kind of moving towards policy, but it's technical guidance that's been developed by the agency on this topic of M&A for inorganics. And kind of to weave into this discussion, I want to kind of highlight the differences between M&A for organics and M&A for inorganics. As many of you might know, M&A for organics has been around for quite some time, several decades. And so folks, you know, consultants and regulators working with M&A for organics as that comes onto the table at different sites have kind of a track record to look at. There's a lot of experience and experience and issues relating to the application of that technology, success stories where things have gone wrong. When we come into the inorganic world, there really isn't that track record. And there are a whole range of other issues that we need to be thinking about. So I'm going to try to highlight those as we go along. And then I thought it'd be interesting to give some site-specific examples, different sites that we're working on. One is the East Helena Superfund site, which is a former ASARCO lead smelter in Montana. And then the other one is the Cloud Buena Vista Superfund site, which is in California, which is kind of a newer site for us that we've been working on. And I'm told that the Cloud and Buena Vista, which are two different former mercury mines were actually at one time the biggest producers of mercury in the country. So I apologize that these aren't Minnesota-specific examples. I just don't have any to talk about. So this is these pictures down here are the covers of these two volumes of the framework that we have. You can find it. Hopefully you can see that website, as I think these presentations are going to be posted online at some point, so you'll be able to get it there if you wish. Okay, so EPA structure, of course, the mission here of EPA is to protect human health and the environment. And there's kind of three different components of the agency, if you will. One being the program offices, which are out of D.C. These guys are largely responsible for writing the policies, and they have to deal with the current administration. And then you've got the regional offices. The U.S. is broken up into 10 different regional offices. Minnesota's in Region 5, which is headquartered out of Chicago. And here, the regional offices, these are kind of the primary interfaces with the states and the tribes. And it's where the enforcement activities are taken from. And then you've got research and development. This is the part of the lab or the agency that I'm from. There are about a dozen or so national labs around the country focusing on different media or different types of topics that they work on. And so the goal here in research and development, of course, is to support the regional offices in terms of the problems or conduct research that kind of helps them with the issues that they're facing. And then as new policy gets developed, of course, ideally that policy's grounded in sound science. And so I think you're going to see examples of both, where we're supporting regional offices and where these technical framework documents are actually leading into an updated policy for the agency. Okay, so the part of ORD that I'm from is National Risk Management Research Laboratory, which is headquartered in Ohio. I'm actually from a satellite division that focuses on groundwater. It's located in Oklahoma. And this lab has kind of had a long tradition in doing groundwater research, heavy component, looking at contaminant transport and fate processes, basic processes of contaminant movement, the subsurface. DNAPL is still a huge concern around the country at Superfund sites, so there is a significant component of research still looking at DNAPL remediation, for example, looking at in situ chemical oxidation, thermal methods. We're also doing quite a bit of work with metals using reactive barriers and MNA, which is what I'm going to be talking about here. And then some kind of newer areas of aquifer storage and recovery is coming up around the country. It's something that's of interest, carbon sequestration. There's also a couple of folks working on concentrated animal feeding operations and potential impacts to groundwater. And then also some nanoparticle applications. Okay, so a little bit of background on M&A. As I mentioned earlier, this field of M&A for organics has been around for a couple of decades. We have protocols, technical protocols for dealing with that, such as the one here. This is for dealing with chlorinated solvents. I think it was published in 1999. And as time went by here, we began to get more requests from some of the regional offices coming up with sites where responsible parties wanted to use M&A for arsenic or for some other metal, for example. And the question that came from the regions, of course, is, well, can we simply use this protocol that we have for chlorinated solvents? Does that work? And if it doesn't work, could you please develop something that we can use? And then around 2000 or so, the Science Advisory Board, which is a outside peer review panel, looked at the research program on M&A and suggested that we started a stronger inorganics program. And so that started a more significant program, developing these technical framework documents and also some research, field-based research to support that effort. We put together a panel, folks from academia, from other national laboratories and other federal agencies to complete this. The writing was finished in 2004. It went through a fairly extensive review process, both internal and external to the agency. And then in 2007, 2008, the first two volumes were published. and we're finishing up a third volume and expect to finish that this year. So, as I said, I guess Ernie said it earlier, don't believe anything I say about this stuff, because I'm not talking about policy. I'm not allowed to talk about policy. I get to talk about the science of the official EPA policy is in what's called this OSWER directive. That's Office of Solid Waste Emergency Response. And this is fairly old. I think it came out at the same time as the chlorinated solvent protocol came out. And some of the topics in the directive here is that M&A is most appropriate where we have situations where our plume is stable or receding in size, which makes sense, of course. It states that EPA expects that in most cases where we have groundwater contamination, that source control measures are going to be taken. It indicates that if you're going to apply M&A, that you should do some work in terms of identifying the mechanism or mechanisms of attenuation. And there's not a whole lot of language on inorganics in the directive. But what it does indicate is that, or it recognizes that these contaminants are going to persist in the subsurface in most cases. So we're not doing alchemy. I mean, arsenic remains arsenic. And so although we may have a transfer of arsenic out of the aqueous phase into the solid phase, it still persists in the subsurface, and we have to deal with that. And so now this policy is actually being updated to include a lot more of issues relating to the inorganics. So that's expected in the next year or so. Okay, so if we look at a real generalized site scenario, but one that we come across at a lot of different hazardous waste sites around the country, is we have some source area, source of contamination, where waste move through the vadozone, move into the groundwater, and begin to set up plumes that move in the direction of groundwater flow. And then as those plumes move out, they can potentially interact with downgradient receptors like surface water bodies, so we get this whole field of groundwater-surface water interactions, where we can impact both aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems, and potentially impact domestic or municipal water supply wells. And so kind of a scenario that's often applied in terms of dealing with these types of issues is one, I think, a lesson that was taught to me when I came to the laboratory, to the groundwater laboratory, something that had been learned early on, was that if you want to clean up groundwater, if you really want to do it, one of the first things that you need to do is deal with the source area. And so that's usually where we start or get people to begin to look at this problem. And there's a number of ways of doing that. We can remove the source if that's something that we can afford to do or if it's practical. But there are other technologies that have been developed to isolate the source, either putting in slurry walls or to stabilize the source using types of soil mixing and stabilization processes. But that's usually where cleanups, or we hope that cleanups usually begin. By dealing with the source, you usually get the most bang out of your buck here. But then where plumes have been developed, other types of in situ technologies are often applied. Reactive barriers is one of interest. Also, in situ bio or other types of techniques. And the idea here is to cut off the flux of contaminants that have moved away from source areas. M&A is probably most appropriate in regions that are more distal, more dilute portions of a plume, perhaps more hard to access portions of a plume. And that's where kind of EPA sees M&A fitting into the cleanup picture as a polishing step or as a component of a series of different technologies that might get applied. Okay. So the issue with organics versus inorganics, of course, this is probably something easy to understand, but for organics, what we hope to see through time, if we're looking at a plume in map view, for example, is a decrease in the size of the plume. That's indicating that natural processes are dealing with the contaminant and it's being removed from the system. And usually when we're talking about, let's say, chlorinated solvent, M&A, we're looking at, you know, TCE or PCE degrading into CO2 eventually. And so you get this innocuous, well, CO2 is not necessarily a bad thing or a good thing anymore to produce, but I mean, we're losing the toxic component and producing something that's non-toxic. For inorganics, we have to recognize that as we lose our aqueous phase plume, we're looking usually at a mass transfer process where that contaminant is leaving the aqueous phase and it's being sequestered onto the solid phase. And so as we lose that aqueous phase plume, we're necessarily growing a solid phase plume. And we just have to remember to recognize that contaminant is still on the subsurface and it could potentially be remobilized through future changes in geochemistry or biogeochemistry. Okay, so more on this point. Existing protocols that we have and that are commonly used for dealing with M&A, they don't include this kind of discussion or how to handle metals and metalloids. Immobilization. We'll talk a little bit about attenuation mechanisms, but immobilization is likely going to dominate over transformation in most cases, except, for example, when we're talking about nitrate, MNA or perchlorate respiration. Those are processes, and we'll look at an example of this, but where the nitrate's actually transformed into nitrogen gas. So because in many cases, when we're looking at metals like arsenic and lead, cadmium, because we're looking at these non-destructive mechanisms, that requires that we have a more extensive site characterization program set up to understand where the contaminant's going, to answer that question, and then to think about the implications of that in terms of future change. And the other issue that I kind of pointed to is that we don't have a whole lot of complete case studies where the whole process has gone through here and this type of technology has been applied. So briefly here, I'll just show one slide on kind of some of the science behind the attenuation processes. But attenuation is due to some biogeochemical reaction. And so, for example, we have our contaminant, which is reactant. It is going to react with some component that's either in the groundwater or within the aquifer matrix to produce some product that is our attenuated product. So some examples of immobilization would be lead, for example, dissolved in groundwater that reacts with carbonate dissolved in groundwater to form a lead carbonate mineral, which would precipitate out and hopefully remain stable in the solid phase. Another example might be copper dissolved in water adsorbing onto an iron oxide that would be present within the aquifer matrix to form a copper-adsorbed goethite form in the sediments, which hopefully would be stable. An example of degradation here, as I mentioned, would maybe be nitrate that is reduced to dinitrogen gas. And in this case, we have a reduced organic carbon that's being oxidized to CO2. So that's an example of where, you know, our nitrate is turning into something, nitrogen gas, which can just simply bubble out of the system. So in volume one of these framework documents, just to kind of give you an idea of the contents of these documents, we start off with a little bit of a regulatory overview. There is a discussion on what we'll call a tiered analysis approach, which on the next slide I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about. It's kind of a framework for doing these types of assessments. There's discussion on the role of modeling in this tiered analysis approach, the types of models that can be used, and kind of getting at the question that was asked earlier in terms of uncertainty of models and using models in these types of feasibility studies. And then a longer section kind of on the background, the science and background of attenuation processes that goes into these precipitation, adsorption, co-precipitation types of processes. And then a discussion on kind of the site characterization tools that we might use to do these types of assessments. So that's kind of the material in volume one. This a tiered analysis approach is four different tiers, and it's kind of a go, no-go type of thing. So you could move through here when you're carrying out some type of site assessment, as M&A comes on the table as a potential cleanup tool, we can begin moving through these different steps to evaluate whether it's going to be appropriate. So the first tier here, as we mentioned, is the plume stable? Or is it receding with time? Or is it growing with time? Obviously, if it's growing with time, I mean, M&A kind of falls off because it's not the capacity of the system is not keeping up with contaminants coming into the systems. And so at that point, you would probably take M&A off the table. Now, You may also come up here, and more typically, you come up with results where it's unclear. That may lead you back into the field to try to put more targeted placement of wells to try to answer this type of question. Okay, so if you move here, if you say, though, okay, the plume is stable, or ideally, if it's receding through time, you want to move into tier two, is to evaluate what is the mechanism, what is controlling that removal of contaminant. And going from there, we want to begin to look at the capacity of the system and the stability of that attenuated component within the subsurface. And so you may get down to this point and say, well, we've got some attenuation process that is currently active, but we don't expect that there's enough of a certain reactant, perhaps organic carbon in the subsurface, to continue that process. And so here at this point, you may move into a more active remediation, a facilitated attenuation, if you will. And so the idea here is that you may come up with information to lead you on to a type of remedy that's going to be appropriate for the site. And then finally, in the tier four, there's the development of a long-term monitoring strategy. Monitoring is an important part of M&A. And then also developing plans to deal with problems should they emerge, if things don't go as expected. And so one of the, I think, strengths of this type of approach is as you move through down through these stages, through these different tiers, you begin to understand what it is that's controlling the attenuation. What that means in your monitoring plan is that you don't have to monitor for everything. You can begin to target the specific geochemical parameters, if you will, if that's what's important, that really control the attenuation process and focus on those types of parameters. Okay, so in the second volume, what the second volume is a review of a selection of different inorganics that were picked mainly by the regional offices where they wanted to see the emphasis on these particular elements. We polled the regional offices, and these are the ones they came up with: arsenic, cadmium, chromium, copper, lead, nickel, nitrate, perchlorate, and selenium. And then in volume three, there's a whole list of RADs that we'll talk about in a little bit. But each of these chapters are broken up into a kind of an occurrence and distribution, geochemistry with attenuation processes, kind of site characterization tools that are specific to these different elements, and then kind of fitting some discussion into this tiered analysis type of approach, how you would want to move forward for these different specific elements. So there's a lot of information in there. The third volume, because DOE was kind of a big player in this whole thing. And so there's a third volume that is should come out this year, but that it deals with all these elements that are significant, essentially exclusively at DOE sites for the most part. And in terms of mining, I think this is how Steve actually found me to begin with on the internet to come and talk about this. We put out an issue paper a couple of years ago. Mining isn't really dealt with in these technical framework documents, but we realized, well, you know, most of the inorganic sites that we have around the country are, in fact, mining sites, and so not to have some discussion of that would be a problem, potentially. So we put out an issue paper, and there are other supporting documents on other topics of interest to us. But this is an issue paper. Again, you can find it at that same website, and this was also published in Mine, Water, and the Environment. Bob Kleinman, the editor of that journal, asked us to kind of reformat the work, and he published it in the journal. But the kind of the main take-home message here is that these attenuation processes are occurring at mine sites, and they impact the distribution and kind of long-term fate of contaminants at these sites. But, of course, we know that in most cases, natural processes are just not sustainable in most cases to deal with the heavy loading from mine sites and mine sources. So there's a lot of information in that issue paper. If you're interested, you can go to this website to pick it up. We're going to move here and start looking at some of these field sites, and I'll give you kind of a flavor of things and topics that have come up at these two different sites. The first one is the East Helena Superfund site in Montana. This is a former Asarco smelting facility. which is kind of, it closed down operations in 2002. It started up in the late 1800s, so there's many, many years of operation at this facility. It's a former lead smelter. It was a custom smelter, so they took in ores from all different parts of the world to form produce a lead ingot, which would go to other facilities to get out the precious metals. And what we're dealing with at this site is largely arsenic and selenium in groundwater that is migrating off-site. And there are also lead, cadmium, and zinc plumes that are more restricted on-site. And those have been kind of largely forgotten. They were never much of an issue. It's becoming more of an issue now that the facility's closed down and the state is taking over the site. They're more concerned about those plumes now than what's been concerned about in the past. So what you have here is the slag pile, kind of the facility itself here, town of East Helena. And you've got these two lakes, Upper Lake and Lower Lake, which essentially represent the constant head boundary that drives groundwater flow underneath the site off to the north and to the west. And so as that happens, it picks up constituents that have been deposited here over many decades and transports them towards East Helena. Some of the particular areas on the site that are of interest is this spice handling area. That's really where the main arsenic hotspot is. The spice was a material that they produced. It was very soluble and rich in arsenic, and that just simply got watered down, percolated into the subsurface. And when they first put the wells in here in the early 80s, they had concentrations of arsenic that were up around a gram per liter. So these were some of the highest arsenic concentrations in the country. Since that time, they've come down, it's attenuated, down to 200 milligrams per liter, but still moving in the right direction. Another area that kind of produces another plume is in the sediment drying area right here. And then, of course, it's the acid plant where the heavy metals are mobilized based on spills from that acid plant through the years. Okay, so what we have here, this is kind of, if you can see this, this is what the arsenic plume looks like. You've got this high concentration, well, this is the spice area, high concentrations here, and kind of a cigar elongate shaped plume moving off with a more dilute feature underneath the slag pile as well. The idea here at one time was to cut off, and this kind of goes back to that slide that we showed earlier on, was to cut off this main part of the plume with a reactive barrier. And we actually did some pilot testing of that technology on site here and found that that could possibly work, at least for that particular region of the aquifer. And then, as we talked about earlier as well, this idea of source isolation, source control is really important. And ASARCO, before they went bankrupt, actually got in slurry walls around. They really took it upon themselves to do it, put these slurry walls around these different source areas. And that happened, well, they started down here. That was the first one they went after. That was a little bit easier. And then as these buildings began to be torn down, they were able to get into the spice area and put in a slurry wall around in this region. And interestingly, we've been watching groundwater concentrations now 3 or 4 years after installation of these slurry walls. Nothing's happened, but it's kind of frustrating. It's certainly been frustrating to ASARCO, but the solids have been so loaded up through many, many years that there's really, and you can't really model this very well. It hasn't been modeled. But it's expected that it's going to take some time for concentrations to begin to recede a little bit out of that source area. So just a little bit about the groundwater chemistry here. This is in the region around the pilot scale reactive barrier. Maybe I can show you where that is. Sorry. Right here. So the pilot scale reactive barrier went right in this region, and so there are wells scattered out. This has kind of been the focus of our research on the site, is kind of in this part of the site. This is kind of what the groundwater looks like. It's mainly a sodium sulfate matrix. You've got concentrations that are of arsenic that are low, up to about 50 ppm in that part of the site. The arrow indicates that's kind of the input concentration to the reactive barrier, around 25 ppm or so. Here's our EH-pH diagram for arsenic. This is probably familiar to most of you here doing groundwater types of work, but this is kind of a way of showing, of course, the speciation of arsenic in terms of these two variables, the oxidation reduction potential and pH. And so what we've done here is looked at the points themselves represent what we've measured in the field in terms of the ORP and the pH, and then the colored symbols represent what we actually measured doing speciation analyses in the laboratory. And what you see is generally where you have a measured speciation that is dominated by arsenate or the more oxidized form of arsenic, you tend to be up in the where you would expect to see arsenate. Whereas when you have more reduced measured speciation of arsenic, you do tend to be lower. The correlation isn't that great, but it gives us some sense that things are making sense here. The interesting thing about this site that has changed kind of the whole picture, and this is kind of can be a focus of a whole talk, is the behavior between arsenic and selenium. The focus had always been on arsenic here, for good reason, and the state actually picked up and found that there was a selenium plume. SARCO had missed it, and EPA had missed it. Interestingly, all our work was kind of in a region where selenium was non-existent. If we had moved over a little bit, we would have seen fairly elevated selenium concentrations. And so this is kind of changing the whole remediation strategy. Arsenic is becoming less of a driver, and selenium is becoming more of a driver. And that's mainly because if we move up towards East Helena, the selenium plume is migrated further. And it's further, much further down gradient. And so what's striking here is where you have arsenic at high concentration, selenium is essentially absent, and the other way around, which is really kind of a striking feature at the site. And what we think is going on here, along with the spice area, where that is the major source of arsenic contamination here, we've been told that sometime in the 20s there was a large diesel spill on site. So a large source of organic carbon. And so you put the organic carbon in a big source of arsenic, and that really is a problem because arsenic tends to be very mobile under reducing conditions. There's really nothing to pull it out of solution. And so we've got kind of a more reducing corridor where arsenic is in the trivalent arsenite form and where concentrations are high and where there's plenty of organic carbon. And so there's ferrous iron in solution. ORP values are low. Whereas on the periphery here, we have more oxidizing conditions. And so the deal is selenium actually can precipitate out. And we're trying to figure out exactly how that's going on, but it looks like there may be kind of elemental selenium precipitating within that reducing core. And so these redox conditions are promoted by this old diesel spill are kind of really setting up the way these plumes look at this point in time. So that is kind of changing the whole picture. Now, in terms of M&A, there was an idea early on to look at M&A processes off-site as that plume becomes dilute and moves further down gradient. And so I want to go through kind of, this is information that's taken from the technical framework documents that is relevant to arsenic, the kinds of things that ASARCO, when they were ASARCO, were beginning to look at. Now other consulting firms are beginning to pick up. So in terms of immobilization mechanisms for arsenic, we've got precipitation, co-precipitation, and adsorption, different types of minerals that arsenic can be associated with. A couple of points here. Co-precipitation often occurs near plume edges, and that's where we have rapid gradients in redox conditions. That's oftentimes where you'll see these types of co-precipitation processes for arsenic. And because arsenic is mainly an anion, we get adsorption that's much more prevalent at lower pHs, where mineral surfaces have a positive charge. That's where they tend to stick to anions. And so if adsorption is a key attenuation mechanism, it's typically at lower pHs. Okay, in terms of arsenic precipitation, here's another EH-pH diagram. But we've modified this, so now we've got iron and sulfur in the system. So briefly, you've got this kind of wide area on the top part of the diagram where arsenic can precipitate out directly as a ferric arsenate. Thin wedge down here where you can get orpiment precipitation. But the main point here is that in most of our groundwater regions where we're looking at this kind of EHPH region, you don't have these solid faces occupying the stability regions for arsenic. And so precipitation is usually not something that we see naturally occurring for arsenic. And that's one of the problems with arsenic. It doesn't readily attenuate. Now, if you add iron into the system, things change a little bit. The picture changes. Here, now we've included an EHPH diagram for iron, and you've got a broad region for iron oxyhydroxides, for iron sulfides, and magnetite. There's a little wedge right here. And so one thing that research over the past 15 years has shown pretty clearly is that absorption of arsenic is tied to or shows a common link to the abundance of iron-bearing minerals. That's pretty well known now. So we have these oxyhydroxides such as ferrihydrite and goethite in oxic conditions and various iron sulfides like mckennoite and pyrite in sulfate-reducing conditions. And one of the key things here is that we see the highest arsenic mobility under conditions where we've got iron-reducing conditions, that is, our substrate, our oxides are disappearing, so there's no place for arsenic to go, and in the absence of sulfate reduction, so where we don't get that microbial process taking or kicking in that can provide new substrates, iron sulfides, to remove arsenic. So it's in this region where we've got iron-reducing conditions, but lack of sulfate-reducing conditions. That's typically where we see the worst arsenic problems around the country. Okay, so in terms of characterization data, obviously these redox conditions and pH are very important for understanding how arsenic is going to behave. Hopefully understanding the mineralogic composition of the aquifer is going to feed into these types of assessments. That's obviously very important. Also, measuring the speciation of arsenic in the field we think is important. Typically, we have these oxyanions of arsenic 5 and arsenic 3, arsenate and arsenite, but others can be significant as well, especially in systems where we've got active sulfate reduction. There's a whole range of different thiolated arsenic compounds which don't show up typically in the standard laboratory measurements. You have to do special things to detect those, but they are out there in more reducing types of settings. And also some of the organic arsenic compounds show up as well, depending on the geochemical conditions as well. So actually measuring the speciation is an important part of these types of assessment programs. Sample integrity is very important. When we're looking at solid cores, preservation of redox conditions really can direct the type of results that you get from solid phase testing procedures. Water samples also need to be kind of collected with some care. Kind of the method that we've used and found to be quite useful. Obviously, you want to prevent precipitation of any dissolved components because as those precipitate out, they can remove arsenic or otherwise transform it in your sample, so you obviously want to avoid that. And the way to do that is to minimize air exposure. Acidifying samples, and that prevents iron minerals from precipitating out. If sulfite is present, that's a problem because you can actually get precipitation that's driven at lower pH conditions. And so that's where we run into a problem. If you have dissolved sulfide present, you don't want to acidify. And then filter, and we usually collect samples into amber bottles. And that turns out to be a fairly good approach for preserving arsenic speciation. This is a pretty good, you can find this website. This is a pretty good, it's a little bit dated now, but it's pretty good discussion of arsenic collection procedures and different issues relating to collecting samples and analyzing for arsenic. Let's talk a little bit about another site. This is just the title slide that I took from an update that I just recently gave to Region 9. This is a study that was at the Cloud Buena Vista. These are mercury mines out in California. And the issue here or that the region was interested in, we've got the formation of these efflorescent salts throughout the site that pop up during dry parts of the year. And we're going to zoom in on this other picture here. You can see these white salts that kind of bloom during the dry season. The idea here is that there's shallow groundwater flow, and that groundwater gets wicked up during the dry season and precipitates as these salt mats throughout the site. These are mainly magnesium sulfates. Hexahydrite and starkeyite are the two different magnesium sulfates. But in addition to just having magnesium sulfate, there's a whole range of metals that get tied up in these salts as well. And I love this picture because the issue that the region was concerned about is, of course, once the wet season comes, the salts completely disappear and they can be removed in a day or two through heavy rains. And so all the, the question that the region has is, are all the components that are associated with those salts simply transferred into water and are running off the site? And they're concerned about this because there's a reservoir a couple of miles hydraulically down gradient that is being filled up and is going to be the water supply for a large number of people in California. So there's concern about this site. What I like about this picture is that you've got these drainages, obviously, where the water is going to go, filled with these iron oxyhydroxides. And we already talked about that. These types of minerals are really great for removing inorganics from water. And so here you've got your source term and then potential sinks throughout these drainages. And so there is questions about kind of how these different types of contaminants that are of concern at the site are going to respond both during the rain events and as they get tied up into these different drainages. Okay, so briefly, just a couple things that we've done. A conceptual site model, obviously these salts provide a source of inorganic contaminants during precipitation events. In scenario one, you might consider that all the elements associated with the salts would dissolve into solution and be carried off. Or in scenario two, that other types of mineral water interface processes, attenuation processes, could sequester some of these metals. And there's kind of an interest in just developing the conceptual model for the site to kind of unravel these things. And so the main question is, are all the components in these salts soluble? And so we initially thought about conducting... We run out of time? Sorry about that. I'm going to go quickly here. We've looked at nickel and arsenic and mercury. And what we find when we group these elements out quickly, we see that mercury is quite refractory. It doesn't get dissolved. It's present in high concentrations, but it really doesn't get dissolved. Whereas some of these other metals have a more pH-dependent response that we can predict, and so their mobility is very much dependent on the pH. I'm going to skip that, and I'm just going to run through a couple of closing take-home messages that we typically include in training that we provide in M&A. First, M&A is likely to be used in combination with other technologies, that we have to account for the growth of a solid phase plume when we're dealing with inorganics, and not just the removal of the aqueous phase constituent. I'm a geochemist, and I usually do these talks with a hydrologist, and they're always here to remind me how important hydrology is, that where the water is going is probably even more important than the geochemistry stuff that I think about. So groundwater hydrology is critical here. The mobility of contaminants depends on kind of this biogeochemical response in aquifers, interactions between the aqueous phase and the aquifer components. Models, we don't really talk about modeling so much, but we need to move past just kind of qualitative models and develop more quantitative models. But these have a range of uncertainties. And this tiered analysis approach that we've gone through is, I think, a useful means of kind of setting up these types of assessment programs. That's it. Thank you, Al.